This is 5 and 10 from Skywatch TV for October 30th, 2020. I'm Derek Gilbert. Another terror attack in France has the people of that nation questioning the role, the place of Muslims in their society. We'll talk about this with an expert who we've had on the program several times in the past. He's the author of a book that I found extremely helpful in preparing for my own book, Bad Moon Rising. The book, Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West, highly recommended. We welcome back to the program Raymond Ibrahim. Raymond, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Derek. Very good to be with you.
Folls the attack in the city of Nice, where three people were killed at the Notre Dame Basilica there. A Tunisian man with a knife who only arrived in the country apparently within the last 3 or 4 weeks. I have to believe if such a thing were possible, Charles Martel would be spinning in his grave right now. What is going on in France? This was the third attack in less than 2 months. Why is this happening, and is this reflective? How does this reflect a fundamentalist Islamic belief in the teachings of Muhammad?
Well, you know, and to give it deeper context and therefore more importance, we had what you mentioned, the recent attack, which three people were killed in a church. One woman, I think, was, they quoted it as virtually beheaded.
Right.
Okay. And the man, by the way, was shouting Allahu Akbar, Islam's war cry, thereby obviously positioning his attack in religious terms. And before that, of course, we had the teacher who was also beheaded. And his head was severed. I mean, I've seen some graphic pictures where it was thrown around because the Muslim man who cut his head off was later on mocking it and so forth. And that, too, was done in the name of Islam because he had so supposedly blasphemed by showing Muhammad cartoons, but in the context of teaching students about free speech. And then before that, there have been so many attacks. Let's not forget France was also home to that Catholic priest where two Muslim men walked into his church and slit his throat mm-hmm. during mass. I think it was maybe 3 years ago. And we've had so many, and the latest attack in Nice before that, remember, there was another huge terrorist attack, I think also 2-3 years ago, where a Muslim man drove a truck and he killed, I think, 85 people.
Right. That was 2016.
Yeah, that's the backdrop of what's happening, which is to say this has been going on for quite some time. And, you know, beneath that, we hear the sensational big news, like the recent ones, the beheadings and so forth. But which makes it so that lesser spectacular news doesn't even reach us. But the fact is, you have Islamist type attacks and vandalism and graffiti, especially targeting churches. One report estimates that two churches in France are attacked daily. Okay. And a lot of the graffiti would suggest it's a Muslim, the Allah Akbar type stuff. And we recall, of course, Notre Dame and all that. Which is not this, we still don't know, obviously, but I think we even discussed it way back. It was interesting because they came up right away and said, no, it's not terrorism, even before they knew what it was. So there's, you know, France has an issue with Islam, and that's because France has the largest Muslim population. So it just makes sense. The more Muslims you have, the more of the stuff of Islam you're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because, and this takes into account that Muslims, not all Muslims are doing this, but let's just throw out a number, 10% are so-called radical, let's just say. So if you have 100,000 Muslims, that means 10,000 are radical. But if you have 1 million, that means you have 100,000. So that's, I think, the big problem for France, and that's why someone like Macron is becoming a little more verbal and assertive, though obviously he's still not able to pinpoint the real problem because it would be politically incorrect for him to do so. Even though he's being forced to move that way because his country, I think most recently he said his country's under attack. I mean, that's how bad it is. And, you know, if you talk to people, there's cities and neighborhoods that nobody enters. It's Muslim-run areas where Sharia essentially, unofficially, is being practiced. The police that go in, if any, are usually Muslims from the neighborhood. And, you know, they're just little enclaves. And it's this isn't just France, by the way. You have this all throughout North and Western Europe, primarily Northwestern Europe, Scandinavia, the UK is very bad, Germany. So in a way, what we're seeing in France is, you know, just is the tip of the iceberg of what's going on everywhere now. And it's not surprising to me. And, you know, after a little bit, if we have time, I'll kind of give you an analogy of why I think It's, you know, what Macron and all these people are trying to do, even though it sounds positive, the, you know, the sorts of measures they want to take to safeguard against this, it's doomed to failure.
In your book, Sword and Scimitar, you outlined the history and the key battles in this history of war between the rise of the Islamic powers from the early days following the Prophet Muhammad. I mentioned Charles Martel, who fought the famous Battle of Tours in 732 AD. But even as late as the 17th century, the late 17th century, Jan Sobieski, the King of Poland, had to rescue Vienna, which is essentially the crossroads of Europe. From there, had the Ottoman Empire won that battle outside the gates of Vienna, the German states to the north, Italy and the Vatican to the south, and Western Europe would have been wide open. I learned from your book that Muslim pirates had an outpost on a small island just off the coast of Cornwall, Western England. And this, 60, 70 years after the first English colonies had been established at Plymouth in Massachusetts. We don't hear about this. We're taught that there is no place for terrorism in Islam, and radical—the phrase "radical Islam" is usually applied to events like this, these terror attacks in France here recently. Is this really radical, or is this mainstream? People are actually taking the Quran seriously.
Well, as you point out, if you know, there's two ways to look at it. You can look at the doctrine of Islam, and then you can look at the history of Islam, see how Muslims have behaved. The doctrine is radical Muslims are just following normal Muslim doctrine. So, for example, killing a blasphemer, that's Islamic. That's in the texts. Muhammad himself actually had a Muslim man go murder a woman who was breastfeeding her children in the middle of the night because she was mocking him. Okay, so you can see the precedent. This is part of the doctrine. But then the history, as far as I'm concerned, is more demonstrative of just how of the fact that what we call radical is really mainstream. You know, the continuum that you just offered of Islamic attacks on the West from, you know, Vienna and, you know, attacking England and Britain and so forth, it actually gets worse. Our very first war as a nation was with Muslims who were, again, engaged in jihadi rhetoric, the Barbary Wars. So after America became independent, the very first war was with Muslim states who were enslaving American sailors, plundering them. And when Thomas Jefferson flat out asked the ambassador from Barbary, why are you doing this? We've never done anything to you. He said, our holy book commands it. You are infidels. You have three choices, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you got 1400 years of this. And then now we come and say, no, that's not. And they're still doing it. OK, what you're seeing in France and everywhere else, the same sort of thing still happening. And so for people to come up and say, no, that's not true Islam. And this is the problem with someone like Macron and what he's saying. They can never acknowledge that what's happening is integral or a part of authentic Islam. They always have to say, no, there's something going on. It's a radical sheikh. It's a misinterpretation. It's a minority view. It's, you know, it's grievances. We always have to find something else, because the conclusion, if you say it's the religion itself, is obvious, which is, well, it's dangerous living side by side with Muslims.
So the nations of Western Europe, Germany in particular, Sweden has got real issues there with some communities in and around Stockholm. We're seeing the problems in and around Paris with neighborhoods, as you say, where the French are afraid to go. Why are European nations allowing such numbers to arrive? I mean, as you pointed out, in France, the largest Muslim population in Western Europe, 5 million Muslims. It's called the country's number two religion, but I would argue that given the degree to which French actually practice Roman Catholicism, actually follow the religion, I would say Islam is probably the number one religion in France right now. We see in the United Kingdom that Muhammad is one of the top, if it's not number one, it's one of the top five names given to male children born in the last couple of years in England, the land of my Anglo and Saxon ancestors.
Richard.
Yes, it's mind-boggling. Why are the Western European nations collectively inviting so many of an incompatible religion to settle there?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. One is, and I think both are both answers are equal are at work, but to which degree? One is just sheer naivety and insistence on living according to the make-believe narrative that we've all have to accept, which is, you know, multiculturalism is wonderful, and you know, the more non-white, non-Christian people you have, the greater. And, you know, you're progressive and you get to tap yourself on the back because you're so open-minded and enlightened, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's probably bigger amongst not necessarily people who are in charge, but, you know, a few degrees beneath them. And they're because they're indoctrinated in that. And then above that, you know, at the apex of the pyramid of, you know, the shakers and the movers, the powers that be, I think it's intentional. They understand the truth about, let's say, Islam, but whether it's for their globalist agenda or whatever reason, they want to, and a part of it, I always believe, is actually to destroy Christianity as well. Because the more influx you have of Islam, you know, well, you can't say Merry Christmas, you can't do this, you got to be careful, don't offend Muslims. And I think that actually is, really suppress Christianity even more than it's already being suppressed in most of, especially Western Europe. So I think, you know, you have the core is doing this intentionally, but the foot soldiers are just indoctrinated in that silly narrative that we all have to pay lip service to.
The question then is, what's the end game? Because the elites who are inviting this in or setting the policies that allow this influx, they typically are not practitioners of the Islamic faith. So once they accomplish the goal then of de-Christianizing Christendom, then what? I mean, I don't suspect you're going to find elites like George Soros and his buddies at the World Economic Forum are going to adopt Islam as their religion. So what is the next step after they dismantle the Christian institutions of the West?
Well, in my experience, secularists just don't take religion seriously, and they think they can snuff it out easily by giving the religious person, you know, worldly incentives, because that's how they are. Okay, so I think they believe once Christianity snuffed out, getting rid of Islam will be a very easy affair as well. You know, and it's the enemy of my enemies, my friend kind of logic. It's not, as you say, it's not like these elitist Soros types care or like Islam, but they're using it as a pawn, and I don't think they realize, you know, the danger it causes to them because they don't take it seriously ultimately. But the end game, you know, I'll give you a quick analogy from history. So we see what, you know, these Western leaders, Macron and so forth, are trying to do. And they spend billions of dollars on counter surveillance and, you know, reformist Islamic thinking and, you know, all this sort of thing. But here's an analogy. In Spain, okay, real close to France, only 500 years ago, after Islam had invaded it and conquered it through a lot of violence and bloodshed in the 8th century and centuries thereafter, you have the Reconquista, wars, etc. And it comes down to it now, all the Muslims are basically in Granada, but everywhere else in Spain, and they're living as citizens. And initially, the Spanish crown let them practice the religion freely, let them actually enforce Sharia on each other. They could travel and so forth. But what happened is anytime the Muslims were able to, they would attack. Okay, and they became essentially a fifth column, and they would work with the Ottomans, and they would work with whoever to try to kill. And some of these attacks were beyond horrific. I mean, very terrorist. Like at one instance, they took priests and sewed them inside the carcasses of pigs and lit them on fire and mass rapes and so forth. And so what the Spanish crown did, long story short, you know, they finally said you have to convert to Christianity, because as long as you're part of that religion, you're going to be an enemy. It's a tribal type of thinking. And what did the Muslims do? They all converted. But generation after generation of these supposed new Christians being born to former Muslims were still Muslims at heart. And they would learn all the mannerisms of Christianity that even the priests were shocked that these guys are still Islamic after a century, even though they're being baptized and come to church more frequently than our own, you know, native Christians. And what happened in the end, the only solution was they kicked them out. A mass expulsion, and also the Inquisition before it. So that just gives you an indication of how impotent the measures that people like Macron are going to take. Because if Muslims were willing to go to that degree of, you know, pretending to be, you know, first of all, the Spaniards were willing to do something we would never do, force you to convert to Christianity. Sure. But even that wasn't enough, because they learned to internalize the Islam and had the hatred for the Christian and the infidel. And any moment they would strike out. And the only solution was actually mass expulsion. So that just shows you how absolutely lame any kind of initiative from the West that's, you know, consistent with our values is.
Hmm. That does not speak to the possibility of a peaceful solution to all of this. If separation,
it does not. Yeah.
Separation
it
is
does
the
not,
only.
But you know, it has to be said.
Yeah.
And I know most people don't want to hear that, and most people don't want to say that. But the facts are the facts. If we haven't had peace with Islam for 14 centuries, I don't think it's going to happen overnight, because there's something very deep and existentially ingrained in that religion that makes it hostile to the non-believer.
Yeah, well, it's following another god or gods, as I argued
right.
in my book,
right.
that have been hostile to our Lord and Savior for, since almost the beginning of time. What are you working
Absolutely.
On next? Again, your book, 14th Century, Sword and Scimitar, highly recommended. What are you working on next?
I'm actually working on a sort of companion book it's a historical book about Christendom and Islam. But this one's focusing more on biographies. So whereas Sword and Scimitar focused on the key battles, I'm going to be focusing more on basically the heroes of Christendom vis-a-vis Islam. So there'll be little biographies of all of these men, many of them who were not even mentioned in Sword and Scimitar, because to be heroic is not necessarily won with a decisive battle. I mean, a lot of these men actually were part of lost battles, and they didn't have much, such as, you know, King Louis IX of France and his crusade, one of the greatest heroes of Christendom and recognized as such for centuries, but his crusade was a failure. So that's the difference between the two books, is they don't necessarily agree in that. But I think if anyone likes and has benefited from Sword and Scimitar, they'll like this book as well.
Does Jan Sobieski get some play in your book?
Yeah, he's tentatively on the list. I haven't gotten it to him yet. He's in Sword and Scimitar. That's
yes.
the problem. I don't want to be redundant. So
yeah.
I have a lot about him in Sword and Scimitar in Chapter 8 in Siege of Vienna. But yeah, he definitely deserves a full and complete treatment. So we'll see.
Yeah. Look forward to it, and we'll have you back to talk about it when that's ready. Raymond Ibrahim, the author of Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West, online at raymondibrahim.com, where you can subscribe, get updates when he writes his columns, which document the ongoing hostilities between Islam and the West. Raymond, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Derek, for having me.
And we thank you for watching as we keep watch. Have a blessed weekend. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is 5 in 10 from Skywatch TV.
There were giants in the earth in those days. And also after that. It was a time of gods and dragons.
This was supernatural war between Jesus, God, and the old gods.
We live in the final stage of a war that began before God said, "Let there be light."
The gods of ancient Sumer.
These giants are all through the Bible.
The things that are going on in the world right now, I'm sorry, but the writers, they're out.
Now, a fresh look at the end times that reveals the prophecy of the giants at Armageddon. Names the four horsemen of the apocalypse already loose in the world today.
These entities are real entities and not just metaphors
right.
or symbols.
And they're all named.
Unmasks the ancient dragons who walk the earth during the Great Tribulation.
A primordial entity such as Kronos or Chaos, Leviathan, Tiamat.
His breath kindles coals and a flame comes forth from his mouth. What is he describing here if not a dragon?
And unveils hidden prophecies of their ultimate destruction. Giants, Gods, and Dragons by Sharon K. Gilbert and Derek P. Gilbert. New from Defender Publishing.